This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. People talk about how the British conquered India, which is true, but there's one detail about that act of brutal conquest that William Dalrymple says often goes missing. One part of the story that disguises a more complex reality. It's the fact that it wasn't a government doing the conquering. It was a corporation, a big, big business. The East India Company, which was created in 1600 to trade spices and silks. But Dalrymple's book is about how this company became something much more unusual, an incredibly aggressive colonial power which plundered and subjugated vast tracts of southern Asia. It wasn't a national event, he says. It was a corporate event. And his book explores the relationship between commercial and imperial power. William Dalrymple is an historian. His book is called The Anarchy. Your interest in India broadly, would it be too much to say it's your life's work or your life's interest, that region?
No, absolutely. I've been there since I was 18. Yeah. And this is very much the culmination of work I've been doing for about 20 years. Correct.
And why?
Well, it's two reasons. I mean, India's my home because it's the most astonishing place to live, but particularly for a writer, it's like being a child in a sweet shop. There is so much material, so much inspiration. Why the East India Company and why that period? It's a period which is amazingly rich and amazingly important, and when the foundations of the modern world are laid down, and yet it's amazingly understudied. Mm. Everyone always looks at the sort of great ages of Indian history, with, you know, the great moguls when the Taj Mahal is built, or Lord Curzon when the Raj is at its height. But this extraordinary period, often called the Twilight, or the Anarchy, the period between the Moguls and the Raj, is very little written about and very little understood. And there is just so many extraordinary stories, it's so surprising, it's so different from the Raj that one sees on, you know, masterpiece theatres and Passage to India and all those guys in solo topis, you know, swaggering around clubs and playing croquet on the lawns at Simla.
Yeah.
It's a completely different world and one I suppose I've inhabited for 20 years very, very happily.
Well, it gives you a sense of something that you mentioned in the book, that the official memory of this has been spun over the years.
Absolutely. The 18th century knew that India was conquered by a corporation, a corrupt corporation, a ruthless corporation. And one of the big surprises researching it was really quite how much resistance and shock and disgust there was in England at the time to the way that India was being managed. And the language being used is very similar to the sort of language that people use today about, you know, multinational corporations and anti-globalization protesters and this fear that the ruthless search for profit has crushed humanity and destroyed much that is precious in the world. And you get a lot of that in the English press in the 18th century. A lot of people, it's mixed with snobbery. I mean, there's a feeling that a lot of men are coming back from India, new rich, replacing the old gentry, buying up houses, taking over the House of Commons. But there's genuine disgust and concern. And as someone like Horace Walpole, the Whig diarist, says, we have outdone the Spanish and the Portuguese in their looting of the Aztecs and the Incas. They at least had the excuse of religion. We are only after profit.
How much of this for you was just a ripping good history, and how much were you interested in the larger cautionary tale of corporate power and excess? Clearly, the both appeal to you, I'm guessing, anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when you're you know, weighing up different topics that you could write about, you're weighing up various things in your head. You're weighing up, is this something that I want to live with for 3, 4, 5 years? Is it something that's going to sustain me intellectually during that time? You're also thinking, you know, is this going to sell? Am I going to be able to make a book that anyone else wants to read? It's not just me. You know, is there something new to say? Is the new material? And will my book be different from other books that have been written about this before? And this subject sort of came to me really quite suddenly, because I've actually written three earlier history books that concern the East India Company, but they are micro-histories. The first was a book called White Moguls, which was set in Hyderabad in about between 1795 and 1805. And that book told the story. It was a book I was writing immediately after 9/11, when all this rhetoric was in the air about East is East and West is West and the clash of civilizations and all this kind of stuff. And it was an extraordinary story of a British officer who fell in love with a Muslim princess, converted to Islam, married her, and effectively became a double agent working with the Hyderabadis against the company. And it seemed to, you know, overturn all our preconceptions about the British and India and how the relationship between races and religions worked. But it was a micro history. It was just, you know, a few years in one town. Then I wrote another book about the greatest colonial uprising in history, which was the great, well, Indians call it the First War of Independence. In Britain, it's called the Sepoy Mutiny. But it's the great uprising that took place against the East India Company in 1857-8, the final moment of the company. But I focused very much on Delhi and the Mughal court in that 1-2 years. And then I wrote a book about the East India Company's ill-fated invasion of Afghanistan, which was an incredible sort of mirror on British and American adventures in Afghanistan over the last decade. And so all three of these were micro-histories that dealt with this period but didn't look at it holistically as a whole.
Right.
And I thought, you know, now is the moment really to be brave and sort of take on the whole thing, the fact that India was conquered not by the British per se, not out of Downing Street, not by the British Army, but by a multinational corporation who were borrowing money from Indian bankers to train up Indian mercenaries to fight other Indians, and astonishingly got away with it. Even though at the beginning of this story, Britain was just, you know, generating what, 1.3% of world GDP, and the Mughal Empire was generating about 37%. It's an extraordinary tale. And this was happening out of one office block, just 5 windows wide in the City of London. And this was something, you know, as I say, which was known in the 18th century, which people complain about a lot in the 18th century. But in the Victorian spin it, and it gets turned in Britain and in the wider British Empire into a story of, you know, national glory and the creation of an empire. While in the colonized parts of the world, the story is inverted. And it's seen as a story of national oppression and national liberation, but also a national story. Well, in actual fact, it's not. It's a corporate story. It's a story of corporate violence and corporate conquest. And it's very, very odd. It's a bizarre story.
Well, help us understand, or at least underline the significance of that point, that all of this played out, as you mentioned in the book, through the mechanism of a for-profit corporation. Explain why that's significant, especially in understanding that it wasn't the British government that conquered India so much as a corporation did.
So the East India Company was a corporation. It was one of the very first joint stock companies. People calculate it different ways, but probably the fourth of this new type of business. Up to this point, all the businesses in the world were either family businesses, like, you know, Marco Polo going to China is going with his uncle and his father on a family trading trip. Or their guilds, their, you know, the wool workers of Suffolk, pooling their capital in order to go to Bruges and sell their goods. But this was something quite different. This was a new invention of Tudor England, and the idea was that as well as getting your fellow rich merchants who might want to invest thousands of pounds, you opened up the investment of the company to ordinary people. The subscription list for the East India Company mentions haberdashers, skinners, vintners, grocers. In other words, you know, the ordinary shopkeepers, the minor little, you know, street front capitalists of Tudor London. And these guys give their £5 and their £10. And cumulatively, it allows you to gather a quantity of capital that had never been conceived of before for a business. And the East India Company, once it starts making enormous profit, pulls in capital from across Europe. Investors aren't just British. They come from Holland and France and Spain. And in time, this business grows into the largest corporate entity on earth. In many ways, the most powerful corporate capitalist entity in history. Because not only does this entity control vast quantities of world trade, at the height of British power, it's controlling a third of British exports. It's built half of London docks. It's growing opium in Bihar, which it's selling to illegally to the Chinese. Using that money, it's buying tea, which it's selling not only in Europe but in Boston Harbor. When the Boston Tea Party takes place, it's East India Company tea that's dumped there. And this global corporation, for the first time in history, straddles the globe and is able, is engaged in all the, for the first time, in all the sort of corporate chicanery that we know goes on behind the scenes. It lobbies government, it bribes MPs. It actually invents corporate lobbying in 1693, within a year of its birth. This corporation is caught offering shares to MP in return for them voting to extend its monopoly. So the sort of thing that, we always feel must be going on in Washington every day with corporate lobbyists with a variety of degrees of openness and chicanery, persuading governments to alter their foreign policy to assist a corporation, or persuading governments to change legislation in such a way that will increase the power and wealth of a corporation. This whole world is invented by the East India Company. So it's not just the story of Britain. It's not just the story of India. It's the story of really the birth of capitalism and its effect on the birth of colonialism.
There's a moment that plays out in this story, the impeachment of Warren Hastings, which I think we'll be able to get to. But you quote the Lord Chancellor of the time saying something which you have described as the central principle for the book. And he said this: corporations have neither souls to be damned nor bodies to be punished. They therefore do as they like. Explain why this is such an important sort of central idea. I love it, actually.
Because, just like we as human beings have it in our DNA that, above all, we've got to eat, reproduce and pass on our DNA. In the same way, it's essential to the DNA of corporations that they make the maximum profit for their shareholders. That is the driving force. That's the reason they exist. It's why they're there. And it's not a bad thing at all. I mean, the world has benefited hugely from the existence of corporations. The wealth of the world has been enormously enhanced. But it needs regulation. Corporations will asset strip. They will ruthlessly plunder if governments do not step in to protect the interests of the people who are not the shareholders, who can be the victims of corporations. This is a new world when the East India Company is founded at the very end of the 16th century. People don't know that corporations can have legal entities, that they can overwhelm the economies and indeed the armies of nation states. And the sort of world that that we're very familiar with today, where a large corporation like, say, ExxonMobil, if it were a nation today, would be the 14th richest nation in the world, where Walmart and Facebook and Google have enormous power and can play governments off against each other. If Amazon wants to move its headquarters, it can. Last year, it famously played off New York against Boston, California, and a couple of other places. But this has been going on a global scale for centuries. And in the East India Company, you find for the first time the power of the state locking horns with the power of the company. And that intimate dance that goes on between the power of a corporation and the power of the state, and the way that at different times a corporation can work with the state and enhance its power, lend it money, increase its reach, increase its wealth, pay off its debts, and in the way that that it can work in reverse. The corporation can help a company, can protect it with its armies and so on. But they're not necessarily working together. And often the state and the corporation come, their interests are diametrically opposed. So, for example, there's this moment when the East India Company first moves from being a simple trading organization, basically making its money from moving huge quantities of Indian textiles around the globe, as far as places like Mexico, which actually suffers deindustrialization in the 18th century because of the vast quantities of very high quality Indian textiles being imported by the company around the world. The company, has this astonishing power and astonishing reach, which no organization before it had ever had.
An empire within an empire, I think, is how one director
described
it.
That's how it was described at the time, exactly that.
Yeah, I was interested also in just how many people were actually in the company itself. I mean, you quote one Mughal official saying this, "What honor is left to us when we have to take orders from a handful of traders who have not yet learned to wash their bottoms?" And what did he mean by handful? Because it seems like that's the point.
I'm glad you weren't asking what he meant by the second half.
Right. Well, the point, you say that the company was a model of commercial efficiency.
Correct. I mean, these are very small numbers of people. And like all corporations, you know, the East India Company realizes early that, you know, it makes more profits by employing the fewest number of people and working them as hard as possible. And a century into its existence, when it is already the largest mover of Indian goods around the world, there are only 35 people at the head office, an astonishingly small group of people. And even at the height in India, when it has an army of mercenary troops, Indian mercenary troops, 200,000 strong, twice the size of the British army, at that point, there are never more than 2,000 British traders in India. And yet, you know, by the power of money and harnessing the power of capitalism and the latest military technology, they take over the largest, richest, most powerful empire in the world.
We should also point out, this is another one of the themes in the book, the question as to why it was so successful. And you mentioned lots of complicated reasons, of course, but you also say the crucial factor was the support the company received from Parliament. So talk about the relationship, which you say really turned into something of a public-private partnership. This was crucial to the success of the company.
So a lot of jiggery-pokery goes on. And in the Seven-Year War, which is the first moment that the company begins to make large-scale territorial conquests in India, because the company is facing off against the French, and the French have a rival company called the Compagnie des Indes, which is up to exactly the same game, but on, you know, with the interests of the French state and French investors in mind, the company manages to persuade the Admiralty to send out a task force to India. This is the first time that, you know, a large-scale naval force with British Marines is sent off halfway around the world. And the idea is to protect these British trading stations. Now, as with a more recent war, it turns out that the intelligence is faulty. There is no French fleet coming, and it's rather like the weapons of mass destruction. You know, this fleet is a phantom fleet, just like the weapons were phantom weapons. But nonetheless, the fleet set sail, and with this character, Robert Clive, in command. In that first initial battle, before the company's own mercenary army is really up to full strength, it is white British troops sent out from Lincoln who are fighting against the troops of Nawab Siraj ud-Daulah, who is the guy in eastern India, who is the Mughal governor, who has taken on the company. He regards them as arrogant, and they've started building fortifications without his permission, so he just goes and takes them out. Mm. At the end of this, when Calcutta has been conquered by the reconquered by the company, it should have been obvious that having used taxpayers' money and government troops to conquer Bengal, it should have obviously have gone to the government, but it didn't. It went to the company. And the company, rather than just being a trading organization, suddenly turned into a territorial conqueror. It went from a business of empire into the business of empire. Did I say that right? It went from an empire of business to a business of empire.
Yes. Yeah.
The taxpayer has effectively paid for the shareholders of the company to gain vast quantities of some of the most expensive and rich and profitable real estate on the planet. Mm. And, you know, obviously there are parallels in the modern world to this, the way that, for example, in the 1950s, the lobbying of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company led to a joint CIA MI6 coup against the only democratically elected leader in Iran, Mossadegh. A couple of years later, similar lobbying by United Fruit in Guatemala, which controls 40% of agricultural land in Guatemala, leads to a socialist government that's threatening land redistribution to be collapsed in another CIA coup. The same happens in 1977 in Chile when ITT complained about Salvador Allende's socialist government, and it's replaced by a very brutal junta after another CIA coup. So we know, you know, that you don't have to be some sort of lefty socialist anti-globalization fantasist to be aware that, you know, corporations do have this influence on government and do bring about these actions. But what you find with these syndicate companies is that this is when, for the very first time, these possibilities of collusion and so on are experimented with. And this reaches its climax when the company, having asset-stripped Bengal so thoroughly following its full conquest in 1765, and in 5 years, they effectively, you know, kill the goose that has laid all these golden eggs. And and there's this massive, catastrophic famine in 1772, when a fifth of the population of Bengal die in horrible, horrible mass starvation, where a million people are, you know, on the streets of Calcutta and Murshidabad, skeletons are crawling around, women and children cannibalizing their own families and this sort of thing. And in the middle of this, the company increases its dividend from 10 to 12.5%. So the shareholders are sitting in London buying another leg of beef for Christmas and celebrating their increased profits while 1 million Bengalis die. Mm. And these, you know, this is an entirely new situation, but it leads eventually to the East India Company that can't, having asset-stripped Bengal, having drained it of all its wealth, it can't continue to pay the dividends that it's set itself. And, you know, like Lehman Brothers, this incredibly rich, this incredibly powerful corporation finds itself in severe trouble. Right. First one bank goes in 1772, the Air Bank. Then 30 other banks collapse like dominoes across Europe. Mm. The company has to go and borrow first £1 million, then £2 million, then £5 million from the Bank of England, who can't pay it.
Right.
So the government has to come in, and Parliament is recalled, and they vote for an enormous bailout.
Because it's too big to fail. It literally
because
is too
it genuinely
to fail.
Is
yes.
too big to fail. Right. You know, half of British exports would just disappear overnight. Half of the British customs revenues. You know, the company is paying for the country in a way, and that's the point at which the state gets a measure of control over this rogue, previously unregulated multinational. And it begins to become a public-private thing. And then finally, when the company screws up really badly in 1857 with this great revolt, at that point, finally, it's wound up. And it's, in our language, nationalized.
That's William Dalrymple. His book is The Anarchy, The East India Company, Corporate Violence, and the Pillage of an Empire. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Ever since he was a kid, TV writer Simon Rich has wrestled with life's biggest questions. Like, why do bad things happen to good people?
It occurred to me in Hebrew school that maybe the answer was by mistake.
That's what inspired his comedy show, Set in Heaven. This week on Preach, a conversation with Simon Rich about his show, Miracle Workers, and how he uses writing to work through his existential anxiety. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the Scottish historian William Dalrymple is joining us to talk about the East India Company. It was a private business run by a handful of British merchants that managed to subdue and conquer the Indian subcontinent. These guys plundered land. They had their own army. For 50 years, they operated with mostly unchecked power and were still feeling the impact of their influence. Dalrymple's book is called The Anarchy. I want to come back to a figure you referenced earlier, Robert Clive. He's fascinating, I have to say. On the British side, he's probably the most important figure in the story, it seems to me.
He's my favorite villain.
Yeah, sure. Villain, yeah. Absolutely. And in the sense that he was the one responsible for establishing, I guess, the military supremacy. And we'll get to that. I want to spend some more time with the idea that the fact that they had a navy, they had an army, seems stunning. To think about it now, but Clive, of course, he's the early figure here, and you describe him as you know, fiercely ambitious and violent and ruthless, probably mentally unstable. Do you think?
Definitely. He also hated India.
Yeah.
He went out there, you know, only to make a profit. There's nothing in his letters. He's a very intelligent man, but there's nothing in his letters about the beauty of the landscape or the glorious temples or the beauties of the Taj Mahal or anything like that. This is a man who has joined the company to make money. And initially, he's so miserable in India that he actually turns his innate violence on himself and has two failed suicide attempts. Mm. But when the French attack the East India Company in Madras, and Madras falls to the French army, suddenly Clive finds his moment. And he, although he's a clerk, he's an accountant, he's not a military man, he ends up turning out to be this star performer on the battlefield. And in the 18th century, warfare is, you know, a very gentlemanly affair. It's like a game of chess. And people declare war and announce their moves and negotiate with each other. Clive does none of that. Clive attacks in the middle of the night. He attacks in thunderstorms. He waits until it's foggy early in the morning and then launches an incredible attack when no one's expecting it, from a direction that no one can believe he can attack from. He's incredibly ruthless, but he's also incredibly successful.
Yeah.
He's one of those sort of ideal villains who, you know, somehow always call it right. Has this horrible ability to defeat his opponent. And my other main character, who is the Mughal Emperor Shah Alam, is the opposite. He is an extremely honorable man. He's a poet. He's incredibly cultured, writes poetry in five different languages, doesn't pursue his enemies to exterminate them after he's defeated them. And yet, in the same way that Clive just always calls it right, Shah Alam somehow always calls it wrong. Everything he touches crumbles. In the same way that Clive, right up until the end, manages by extraordinary chutzpah to take the correct call each time, even when he's got very small forces. He realizes when, by surprise and ruthlessness, he can defeat hugely large forces and impose his will on India.
Well, give us a sense of how much money we're talking. You say a good portion of the loot of Bengal went directly into Clive's pocket. How much money are we talking about? I thought that was
so. In the money of the time, 2 million goes to Clive and 20 million goes to the company. Now, I believe that currently I went into this in some length, and currently I think it's one multiplies by 52 to get the the correct modern equivalence. So this makes Clive overnight, quite simply, the richest self-made man in Europe. And when he comes back to England with his glamorous young wife, the British newspapers are full of gossip about Lady Clive's ferret having a diamond necklace and so on. but he comes to a very sticky end,
yes.
Made one fortune, then a second fortune, and then being involved in what we would today call insider training, when he hears that the British have won the Battle of Buxar and that, quite unexpectedly, the company has defeated not only the Mughal Emperor but the governors of eastern and central India in this massive battle at Buxar. The first thing he does is, in code, he writes to his bankers in London and he says, "Mortgage all my property. Buy as many East India Company shares as you can." And this way he quadruples his fortune instantly when the share price of the company goes shooting through the roof because they've suddenly seized the whole of North India. So he's a deeply ruthless and extraordinary character. But in the end, he comes to a very sticky finish when, having been arrayed in Parliament and very narrowly exonerated, partly because he was such an extraordinary gifted speaker. He was one of those people that can stand up and just, win a crowd over by the sheer eloquence and confidence of his rhetoric. And having done that, he goes home, and 2 weeks later, he cuts his throat with a blunt paper knife.
I want to come back to Shah Alam, the Mughal emperor. You've described him as sort of the through line, I think, the central focus of the book.
Correct.
Handsome and talented. Shows
brave.
An amazing amount of determination through all this extraordinary adversity. And you sort of talk about the scope of his life. Like at the beginning, when he's 12, he's there when the Shah of Persia invades Delhi and the city is sacked. And he's the kind of rather pathetic figure at the end of his life at 75 when Lord Lake Saks Deli. It's like he's in there in that continuum, I guess.
So at the beginning of the story, Delhi is the single richest city between Istanbul and Edo, Imperial Tokyo. It has a million inhabitants. It's larger than London, Paris, Rome, and Lisbon combined. And into it has gone all the loot that the Mughals have looted from across India for generations, and the Delhi Sultans before them. And Nadir Shah strides in 1739 and just plucks this ripe mango off the tree. And so Shah Alam, you know, has seen as a child Delhi at its very richest, at a time when the Mughals control not just India, but modern Bangladesh, Pakistan, most of Afghanistan. And they've overtaken China for the first time in Indian history as the world's principal industrial producer. So this is a very rich city that Shah Alam grew up in. And by the time the book closes, Delhi is wrecked. It's been properly plundered 7 or 8 times by various different armies. And it's just rubble in the streets. It's like, you know, one of those pictures of, you know, post-war Berlin or something. Mm. And Shah Alam himself has been horribly, his family have been raped, and he has been blinded in an incredibly brutal way by this rogue Afghan warlord called Ghulam Qadir. So by the end of the book, Shah Alam is this blind emperor sitting in a ruined palace, looking out over a largely illusory empire. I mean, it's a very sort of powerful and tragic image.
Mm. Tell the story, if you would. Take us to August of 1765. This is a really crucial turning point. And for Shah Alam, I'm not sure what to make of how he behaves during this moment in time. Set this up for us, if you would.
So in 1765, Shah Alam has just been defeated by the company. Mm. And everything he's worked for has been destroyed. And so, in a sense, he makes the best of an impossible situation and decides to hand over. Well, doesn't decide, is bullied by Clive into handing over the right to collect the taxes and mint the coins and run the economy of the eastern half of the Mughal Empire, which is the richest part. It's where all the weavers are. It's where all the industry is situated.
To a company?
To a private British company based in a boardroom 5,000 miles away in Britain. Mm. And this document is called the Diwani in the history textbooks, which, you know, means nothing to anyone today. But, you know, what it actually is in modern English is involuntary privatization.
Yeah.
It's rather like, you know, this security company, G4S, taking over prisons. But it isn't just, you know, a couple of prisons. It's the entire economic superstructure of these. And again, it's very small numbers of Brits involved here. There's, you know, about 1,000 at this point. And yet they've pulled off this incredible coup and reap the benefits. And from this point, the business model changes. Up until now, from antiquity, Western traders coming to India used to have to ship gold and silver across the seas in order to pay for their goods. And, you know, as early as Pliny, there are complaints that, you know, the ladies in Rome want silks and they rub their bodies with sandalwood and they wear diamonds, all three of which are, you know, exclusively Indian products. Mm. And the gold of the Roman Empire is being siphoned off in vast quantities to the east. Now, this was still the situation 1,500 years later when the East India Company had begun trading. There was nothing particularly the Indians wanted from Britain. They didn't want, you know, nice English cloth that would have been useful in a North European winter, but was absolutely useless in a Delhi summer. So they have to ship bullion over. Now, once the company has got the Diwani, has got the right to control the economy of the Mughal Empire, suddenly everything changes. And rather than shipping over bullion, they just tax their own subjects. So they tax the Indians, and with the profits, you know, once they've deducted the costs of the occupation, they use that money to buy the silk and the cotton and the indigo and the opium and all the things, the tea they wanted from China. And this is a business model that is, you know, absolutely fabulous. You create something out of nothing. It's like alchemy. You merely tax your subjects and buy goods which you then sell for a massive profit. So at this point, the company is like Goldman Sachs at the peak of its profitability. Every person in the company is reaping millions of pounds every year They didn't do a bonus system like you know modern hedge fund managers or something, but they did do whopping payoffs when they retired. And people were shipping over to London 1 million, 2 million, 3 million on their retirement, which actually led to economic historians called the drain of wealth, when you know the wealth of India just in a very short period of time gets siphoned off to Britain. And you know when you go on holiday to England today and go into all those lovely 18th century National Trust houses with pediments and Jane Austen-y parkland and you know sort of Colin Firth striding around in a in a kind of white shirt. All this stuff, is, you know, not all of it, but quite a lot of it is built on money that comes from India, that, you know, the profits of Bengal trade.
Did you get a sense, was there a turning point when the power and the military slash political might of the East India Company could have spawned other corporations in the same mold, or was this just kind of a one-off historically?
Well, there were many other corporations. I mean, the darkest was the Sierra Leone Company that became the West Africa Company, which was basically about slavery. Yeah. I mean, one of the few things that can be said for the East India Company was it didn't actually get involved in the slave trade. Yeah. But other companies in Britain did, based out of Bristol. The West Africa Company was involved in enslaving and shipping slaves from West Africa across the Atlantic Passage to the Caribbean. And there is a Muscovy company that trades with Moscow. There's a Levant company that trades with the Middle East. And so, you know, there are many, but none of them are as big or as rich or as profitable or as powerful as the East India Company. One of them, incidentally, still survives, which is the Hudson Bay Company, which is founded at this time and which, of course, is still going strong in Canada.
But did any of them have a military? None of them had a navy or a...
Many of them had armed men.
Yeah.
You know, most trade in most countries was armed at this period. You know, you didn't. If you were a Chinese junk, you had a few men that did muskets and things. This wasn't exclusively a European thing. Trade, you know, trade was extremely dangerous all over the world. It wasn't just pirates of the Caribbean; it was pirates of the Pacific, pirates of this, and pirates of that. And so, traders, you know, at this period of history, as in most of history, used to travel with you know their own guards and weapons. But none of them developed an entire army in the way the East India Company did. And the East India Company, just to put this in context, in 1799, just as Britain is about to begin rearming to take on Napoleon, the British army is about 100,000 men. It increases very rapidly towards the time of Waterloo, but just 1799, it's about 100,000, while the East India Company has 200,000 troops, twice the size of the British army. That's the scale of it.
At what point did the power of the company come to be officially questioned? You mentioned in the book how by the early 1800s, the British government starts to take a larger role in overseeing and then regulating the company. And there were questions, I think you were referring earlier to questions at the time about the idea of basically a corporation running one of the most important, if not the most important British colonies. That was absurd, that was improper. When does it start to crumble, at least the impression of all of that?
1772, when the Bengal famine breaks out, is the time when the British public wakes up to the fact that these guys are involved in all sorts of very evil shenanigans. And as I say, one of the most sort of cheering surprises of researching this was how angry a lot of the British press was about this. You get, you know, a lot of long, full-scale tirades against the corruption of the company, the evil of the company, the ruthlessness of the company. There is a play put on in the Haymarket where Clive is lampooned as Lord Vulture, and his sort of tame Chief Justice is called Justice Braywell, and one sort of Scottish assistant of his is called McHaggis. I mean, you know, it's like sort of ripping yarns or Saturday Night Live or whatever. You know, they are made into figures of fun, but there is. You know, satire and resistance at home to these guys. But the company weathers that through the Regulating Act. By the time that Clive has committed suicide and in a sense he becomes the sacrificial cow, and Lord North, the same guy who loses America to Washington, Lord North brings in a Regulating Act that imposes a board of control over the directors of the East India Company. That's the moment that the company's power begins to diminish and it loses really control of its own company. And then throughout the 19th century, more and more voices are raised in opposition.
Mention, if you would, this brutal uprising that plays out in the spring of 1857. It seems like, I'm not sure if it was the final straw, but but this does seem to be a moment when a lot in Britain are saying enough is enough.
Yeah, absolutely. It is the final straw. So it's called in Britain still the Sepoy Mutiny. In India, it's known as the First War of Independence. And what is bizarre about it is it isn't, you know, one of the remaining Mughal princes or the Marathas or any of these princely lineages that rise up. It is the East India Company's own mercenary army. It is the sepoys themselves who turn their guns on their officers. And out of 169,000 troops in the Bengal army in 1857, 130,000 revolt against their officers. And it very nearly throws the British out of India even before the Raj has begun. There are massacres of British civilians. The vast mass of sepoys run to Delhi, where they set up the old Mughal emperor as their figurehead. And then it goes horribly wrong, and the company gets its act together, recruits a whole new army from, you know, what's now the area where drone bombing in Waziristan, where all the, you know, Taliban are hanging out. They reconquer India with quite extraordinary brutality. Yeah. Hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians are massacred, particularly in the Ganges plains, in Lucknow, in Kanpur, in Delhi. Any male over the age of 16 is considered fair game and shot dead in the streets. Mm. And so, you know, this can't be hidden. Yeah. This is very public. There are, you know, the Times sends out one of the world's first war correspondents, William Howard Russell, to cover this. Mm. Everyone's reading the papers and the reports of this, rather like Americans reading Vietnam in the 60s. And at the end of it, there is no doubt, you know, the company's finished. It's wound up, and Queen Victoria becomes Empress of India. And you get a new world which is less extractive and comes with a whole rhetoric of governance and, you know, building hospitals and railways and roads and all the rest of it. And pretends to be all about bringing, you know, a civilizing mission, but is probably even more racist. And certainly, there's greater separation of East and West than there was in the earlier period. When, for all the extractive nature of it, it was quite collaborative. You know, a lot of Indian bankers were involved in this. They were, and there was a lot of intermarriage. One in three British men in India at this period is married to an Indian woman. So you swap one form of sort of libertarian free market colonialism for a centrist state form of colonialism. I'm not sure which is worse.
You say in some ways, sort of bringing us now to the present, you say in some ways we're back to a world where the wealth of the West is draining eastwards, where the West is going to the East as a supplicant, you say, begging for contracts in business, that it's sort of shifted there.
Well, this is, in a sense, just the kind of writing of the world economic system back to its original the norm for most of human history.
Yeah.
For most of human history, the richest places in the world have been China and India. These are vast nations with huge entrepreneurial spirit and amazing manufactures. And throughout ancient and medieval periods, these were, you know, the richest, most luxurious places in the world. Then you have this brief 500 years of European colonialism, when, you know, with gunboats and steel, and these empires are crushed, and the colonial edifice is set up. And what's happening now is just really the natural equilibrium returning. And suddenly, you know, it's nothing in a sense surprising that India is becoming this very rich country, growing at 8% a year. That is how it has always been. The bizarre story is how, for 500 years, a trading company operating out of one office block, just five windows wide, with a skeleton staff for much of it, literally 35 people in the head office, 100 years into that history, that this one trading company managed to subdue the great swathe of the Indian subcontinent.
There's that bit of irony that you point out, that one of the most powerful legacies of British colonialism is that joint stock company, which is, as you say, changed South Asia as much as anything else. It may be the most powerful legacy of the West on that.
I think it is. I mean, people, when they talk, you know, there's endless debate in Britain and so on about the legacy of empire, and people talk about building the railways and hospitals and universities and democracy and so on. And then, you know, before that, there was the Portuguese Empire, which spread Christianity. But none of these ideas, I think, have been taken and brought into play as successfully and made indigenous as the idea of a corporation. And, you know, most Indians today work for corporations. Mm. And that's in itself a legacy of the East India Company.
It's a pretty old question of how, I think this is how you put it in the book, how you cope with the power and the perils of these large multinational corporations. You say there's no answer here, how you deal with the power of a corporation and versus the power of a state in that tussle. And I guess I'm wondering, I guess they couldn't get away with something like that today, but you say many of these big, powerful corporations today may not have, you know, their own army or their own navy, but they do manage to bend state power to their own ends, as you put it.
Yeah, they don't need to have cavalry troops and artillery. You know, the new surveillance capitalism, Google is listening to our conversation here. It'll probably be being offered all sorts of nice radio products when I next turn on my phone.
Right.
it's a different form of power today. But it is true. I mean, I think two things you have to say is that, you know, for all the power of modern corporations, A, you know, Google, Walmart, they just don't have, you know, nuclear jets. They don't have submarines, which would be the equivalent today. And secondly, you know, for all their power, they don't actually control sovereign states. Corporations in the 20th century might have been able to topple governments and bring down Mossadegh in Iran or you know, the socialist governments of Guatemala and Chile. Mm. But they didn't actually occupy Chile and Guatemala. There was a junta that did it instead. But the East India Company for 100 years controlled the whole of South Asia. And this is a bit of history that we've forgotten. Mm. And I think we do so at our peril.
It's gone, the company, right? It's completely gone.
Sort of gone.
Sort of gone.
there's a little sort of nice boutique-y tea shop now owned by two brothers from Kerala.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Which I drink its tea. It's delicious. No, there is no East India Company today, but I think its lessons are more universal. Its lessons are that we should be very careful about the power of corporations. I'm hardly a voice crying in the wilderness here. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, as much issues today as it ever was in 1599.
I wanted to say just something finally. Have you say something about, you mentioned how important it is when you're reporting something or studying something to go to a place. And you do mention in the book at the end, going to visit Delhi last year and writing about hiring a small dinghy to go upstream. Say something about that finally. What were your impressions? Because this is kind of a lovely epilogue to the story.
So I think you can't really write a book like this unless you know the geography and you see how things play out. And it was actually Allahabad that I went at the end of this research. Mm. And this is a place where the Diwani, this document handing over control of Eastern India, was signed. And it was also, oddly enough, in exactly the same place, the place that the East India Company was rolled up in 1859 after the Great Uprising. And sitting in a dinghy going upriver at sunset with, you know, little boys fishing on the banks, and this enormous fortress built by the Mughals, so beautiful, so intricate, this wonderful red sandstone. You know, you couldn't really understand how it was possible that just one London corporation could control it from the other side of the world. But it happened. And I think the invisibility of the company is one of the things that was most remarkable about it. I think these enormous corporations don't want publicity. They don't want us to know their power. And in that lies a lot of their power. The fact that, you know, the way that Google is listening or Facebook is monitoring our social media is part of the invisibility of that, the silence of that is part of their strength.
William Dalrymple, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
William Dalrymple. His book is The Anarchy, The East India Company, Corporate Violence, and the Pillage of an Empire. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tway, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.